Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast. I'm Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding people better. You can learn more about this podcast at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. If you like what I do with this podcast, consider signing up for a premium subscription, which gets you an ad-free version of the podcast and lets you see the upcoming guests and interview questions. I've been resharing some of the better episodes from early in the podcast run that haven't gotten that many listens. This episode is a reshare of a talk I had in January of 2022 with the psychologist Kirk Schneider. We talk about the school of psychology and therapy that he focuses on, which is referred to as existential humanistic. And we talk about how he thinks that approach helps people. My last episode was about the strangeness of life and about existential psychology, so I figured this would be a good follow-up. Okay, here's the episode. Today's talk was recorded January 26th, 2022. It's a talk with psychologist Kirk Schneider, who's written or co-written several psychology books, one of which I read recently called Existential Humanistic Therapy. We talk about what existential psychology is and what humanistic psychology is, and what makes those schools of thought different from more well-known and traditional forms of therapy. Kirk is also interested in polarization. One of his books is called The Polarized Mind, which deals not just with political polarization, but more generally with how people can become very fixated on a single point of view to the exclusion of all other points of view. Another book of his is The Depolarizing of America, which is about an approach to heal political polarization. I myself am very interested in existential psychology, and I'm also interested in political polarization and the psychology that drives that. So I thought Kirk and I would have a lot to talk about. Regarding existential psychology, the most meaningful and wise book I've ever read is a book called Existential Psychotherapy by Irvin Yalom. It was published in 1980 and is considered a classic text in psychology. I read it a few years ago, and I thought reading it was like getting several months or even years of therapy. My wife Molly also read it, and she also found it meaningful and life-changing. I've since bought it for many of my friends and family. It's an awesome book, and I highly recommend it. And if you're curious what it is that makes those ideas so meaningful to me, Kirk and I discuss that in our talk. We also talk about why our culture tends to shy away from thinking about and talking about such existential fears. We talk about narcissism and the possible drivers of that from an existential psychology point of view. We talk about how modern life, in letting us see so many different points of view and different philosophies, can be stressful to us due to our desire for certainty and groundedness. Those are just a few of the things we talk about. Kirk's website is at kirkjschneider.com. I'll read some information about him from his site. Kirk Schneider, PhD, is a leading spokesperson for contemporary existential humanistic and existential integrative psychology. He's a co-founder and current president of the Existential Humanistic Institute, a two-term council member of the American Psychological Association, and a two-time candidate for president of the APA. He is also past president of the Society for Humanistic Psychology of the APA, recent past editor of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, a trained moderator for the conflict mediation group Braver Angels, and an adjunct faculty member at Saybrook University and Teachers College, Columbia University. He's published over 200 articles, interviews, and chapters, and has authored or edited 13 books, including The Spirituality of All, The Polarized Mind, Awakening to All, The Handbook of Humanistic Psychology, and Existential Humanistic Therapy. Okay, here's the interview with Kirk. Hi, Kirk. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Zach. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So I've seen the type of therapy that you practice described as existential humanistic, and maybe you could briefly break down how you see those two aspects, what makes it existential and what makes it humanistic.
Well, in a nutshell, which is not easy to do with these terms, obviously, but by existential, I'm talking about basically our relationship to existence and what that implies for living our lives. By humanistic, I'm talking about specifically the human experience of existence. I'm talking about more of our embodied experience of relating to these various themes that are often described in existential literature. like death and isolation, meaning, meaninglessness, freedom, constriction, expansion. So the existential literature can be a little bit abstract at times in identifying, you know, various aspects of what it means to exist. But the humanistic part really comes more directly out of humanistic psychology, which is very much grounded in our whole body experience of what it means to be free, to deal with our finitude, to wrestle with meaning, wrestle with our smallness, our capacity to transcend.
How do you see that compared to traditional, say, Freudian influenced psychotherapy? Is it that it's less system and ideologically oriented and more focused on, you know, what is going on in this person's life? Is that one way to look at it?
It's really more about, again, one's whole body experience of living as distinct from certain categories that the Freudians have tended to focus on. For example, in classical drive theory, the main issues that human beings are purported to confront are sexual aggressive drives versus our moral conscience, if you will, societal standards. That's the basic conflict. In more recent psychoanalytic thinking, it has to do with the human being's relationship to often their caretakers, to early childhood, and how that relates to their current state of functioning, if you will. But in existential humanistic psychology, again, we're really talking about our whole-bodied experience of life, our relationship to, again, to all there is, if you will. So certainly the sexual aggressive dispositions that we deal with as part of that, our relationship to our parents and our cultural systems are part of that. But even more fundamentally, we see our relationship to existence, to being, as underlying those other dispositions. And I guess one example might be the whole drama. I mean, Otto Rank calls it the trauma around birth. There's clearly separation anxiety from the mother, and this relates to attachment theory, which is very prominent in psychoanalytic circles these days. But it also relates, and this is something I believe not talked about enough in psychoanalytic circles, and hopefully through bridge building with existential perspectives, we can open to this broader and, I believe, deeper view, which is that there's a separation from our relative unity with the cosmos, with the mysterious origin of our being, which goes beyond the mother, if you will, not to discount that powerful connection, intra-uterine connection, but there's also an intra-cosmic connection, if you will. So one is moving from a state of relative non-existence, you could say quiescence, unity with the all, again, analysts would say with the mother, to then sudden, abrupt existence, the chaos and confusion of separating from this state of melding. Some might call it, paradise-like. I'm not sure. I wouldn't necessarily give it that description, but some like Eric Fromm have equated it with the Garden of Eden story and a break from paradise. It's certainly a break from something radically, radically different. So this is where we come into the whole psychology of difference, as Otto Rank puts it. This is where we confront a sense of radical otherness. What we felt was unified and harmonious and familiar is suddenly now disunified in many ways, unfamiliar, radically foreign. And that seems to be an underlying factor in, I would say, much if not all of our subsequent anxiety and even traumas. This sense of helplessness and groundlessness, as I would put it. And I know you have written eloquently about the weirdness of being.
A little note here. Kirk is referring to a piece I recently wrote about the strangeness of life. You can find that on my blog on Medium. If you do an online search for Zachary Elwood Medium, you should see it.
I see that as a sort of a synonym or a parallel to the problem that I'm describing, that the basic conflict of our severing from existence, mm-hmm. you know, to this radical life that we've been granted, mm-hmm. which is, I don't want to discount the wondrous aspects of it too, but I think it's a blend of the terrifying and the wondrous, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which I would call a sense of awe.
Right, exactly. And you've written about awe a good amount. I think you even have a specific book on that. But yeah, the concept that the concept that there's a fine line, or it's two sides of the same coin, that something is both awe-inspiring and wondrous and also terrifying. I mean, you could view those things as being almost synonymous in some way. You
know? Well, a flip side of a coin, in a sense. And I think that the more we're able to develop a capacity to be present to and work with that which is radically other and foreign, that primal fear we experience at birth, some would say it even begins to happen when we're jarred in the womb, the more we are supported by our parents, by our culture, to work with that, to live with that, stay present to it, the more capable we are of beginning to become intrigued by the radically other, the groundless, if you will, rather than just terrified and paralyzed. And eventually, hopefully, not only intrigued, but fascinated, creative, become a creative participant in that maelstrom that we're born into.
Yeah, and you said something about how existential philosophy can be a bit dry or abstract for people who haven't really delved into it. And I think that is true. You know, when I was young and I was reading about existential philosophy, or maybe just philosophy in general, I guess when you're younger or haven't delved into it, there can be this sense of like, oh, this doesn't seem related to my life. But I think, you know, the thing I've realized is that existentialism or existential psychology is about these things, these real stresses that we're dealing with, and these real, it's about what life is like. And we often avoid these things, or, you know, we view these fundamental questions or stresses about life as very threatening or even mysterious, or even just something that distracts us from our everyday practical life. But I think these, you know, the more I've thought about them, the more these are the things that really matter, you know, and I think that's what, and far from being something that's abstract or distant, these things, you know, once you wrap your head around what they're really about and how they relate to your life, I think most people will see the real practical value and application to these things and see the benefit. I don't know if you agree with those things.
No, absolutely. I mean, and that's where I believe the humanistic element comes in. You know, to really ground this stuff in, as you say, the real, what many of us experience in our early childhoods, growing up, but I think every day in various ways, especially when we're jarred out of the routine and familiar, we begin to see how and feel how real these themes are. So again, I don't want to discount the philosophical aspects either. I think it's very useful to be able to talk about these themes, but it's more than talking about, from my standpoint as an existential integrative humanistic therapist. It's also about experiencing. And I've experienced it very directly in my own life. And that's where I think we have some parallels as well. I've gone through my own sort of dark night of the soul, mm-hmm. which is a lot of where my own foundations in this field come from.
And maybe that's a good segue into one idea that I've seen discussed by Yalom and yourself, is the idea that the relationship between the therapist and the client, those in the moment interactions, are potentially much more important than any specific psychological strategy or specific school of thought. In other words, that a therapist might have all the best theory in the world, but if they're fundamentally not attempting a real human connection with their client, they may not succeed in helping that person. And in your book, there was in your book with Ora Krug, there was an observation by someone that said something like being too much aligned with or adhering to a specific ideology might prevent a therapist from being flexible and spontaneous enough and having those authentic connections. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how you see the role of that connection in therapy.
Yeah, well, it's like co-creating a field or a soup, if you will, whereby people feel more free to roam within, if you will, more free to be in touch with areas that they formerly blocked off. I call it a reoccupation project, where you're both literally and figuratively reoccupying the parts of yourself that you've blocked off, you know, for a whole variety of reasons, often having to do with how one's traumas in the past were handled, either by parental systems or the culture, or by oneself. But I think the more or less optimal relationship between client and therapist is one where the therapist has some familiarity with that freedom within him or herself, because he or she has been through something of what they're holding, they're working with in the client. It certainly doesn't have to be the same thing by any means, but to have a profound sense of what anxiety is about, I think, is very, very critical in helping co-create that disarming soup or context where the client is enabled to live with and make the best of the depth and mystery of life. And that's actually my definition of life-enhancing anxiety, which I've been looking into more and more. I feel like this is a really fundamental concept to existential humanistic therapy and for our lives. So often we block off anxiety. We have so many ways of doing that today. And that's where we get into these rigidities and we become polarized. What I call the polarized mind is the fixation on single points of view to the utter exclusion of competing points of view. Mm. And how do we become polarized? Out of terror, fear. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's fear-driven. But what we're hoping to co-create in these existentially oriented depth therapies is a place where one can, in some sense, revisit or restore the terrifying places that one has experienced right from that primal fear, birth fear, such that one feels more capable of participating in or even experimenting with, exploring, playing with, being intrigued by, or even fascinated by the rumblings within, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, the sadnesses, the fears, the angers. So much of this work is about helping people to begin to come more from a place of curiosity about these places rather than abject terror and reactivity. I'd also call that a shift from a reactive place to a more responsive place through the therapy. Just to give you a quick concrete example, I feel I moved very gradually from a place of abject terror when I was a kid. This was partly based on the loss of my brother when I was very young and how that not only impacted me, but my family system, my family. But I then, thanks to the great wisdom of my parents, went into a psychotherapy as a young child. And gradually through that therapy and then a later one, and when I was in graduate school, I was able to move from terrifying places incrementally to intrigue and eventually wonder and fascination with these bigger themes about life that came up mm-hmm. through that break in my being and the routine and familiar way of being. Mm-hmm. Is that making sense?
Yeah, it made me, I was going to say, it seems like, I mean, for me, and I think for many people, the value of the existential philosophy and existential psychology, the value of some of that can be even in just being able to put names to, you know, recognizing and realizing that these are existential, that these are problems and stresses that come with existence, that you'll never fully escape these stresses, that these are always right. with us. And I think the value is in recognizing that, being able to put words to it. Mm-hmm. And also, sort of like you were saying, there's that value in accepting that.
Yes.
And by accepting it, you immunize yourself in some sense, you know, to those fears and stresses. They become less daunting because you have wrapped your mind more around how they are always with us and how, you know, they are just a fundamental fact of human life.
Well, yes, I would say accepting it, but also for those who can take the fuller trip, re-experiencing those places. So going beyond having a kind of intellectual mm-hmm. understanding of them, but actually being able to stay with the impacts of those experiences with one's whole bodily being, mm-hmm. so that those parts of one's body that are activated by the anxieties tend to be less and less frightening, less and less foreign. They become more of the water you swim in, if you will. It is something like being in a dark basement. At first, it's shocking, it's jarring. You bump into this pointy object or something crashes. Mm-hmm. You're on tenterhooks. But if you can stay with your experience, and especially if you have a mentor,
some support,
you know, a loving mm-hmm. guide, support with you, you begin to see things in a different light. And it actually, more light often is accessible to you. And what you thought was some horrifying mm-hmm. Monster, it was actually maybe a rocking chair mm-hmm. that you might want to sit in, you know?
Yeah, I think about that a good amount, how you have to be willing to face those fears and anxieties, which is, you know, easier said than done in a lot of cases,
but absolutely,
but we have that desire to, some of these existential stresses of various sorts, you know, these things that bother us so much, I think we all have that desire to shy away from them and not examine them and say, you know, I'm going to avoid going with the flow with this anxiety to see where it leads me. You know, we have these mental blockers up, and you can kind of build up fears that are greater than, you know, that's how you can build up some pretty extreme fears around, like, oh, I can't let myself experience this anxiety. I must find a way to avoid experiencing it. You know, you build those things up in your mind so much. But yeah, I think they're
absolutely,
this comes up in conversations with my wife when we're talking about, you know, her anxiety. And I sort of like you were saying, it's like, well, see where those thoughts take you and don't be afraid to really delve into them, you know, if you can, of course.
Right.
It's always hard to make, you know, blanket statements like that, but there is something, yeah, there's something to that.
Yeah. Sure. I would call it finding ground within groundlessness. You know, there's a whole spectrum. There's a range within which we're able to do that. Some people are able to acclimate fairly well to very broad and deep ranges of human experience. Others, you know, less broad and deep. But I think the point is for each person to kind of soul search that mm-hmm. and go as far as they feel they can go. I just think it's wonderful if we have, you know, mediators or healers who can help us to take those journeys. Because too often, especially in today's world, there's an emphasis on the quick fix and the instant results, mm-hmm. you know, either through our devices or through very, you know, short-term formulaic kinds of medicines or therapies, mm-hmm. which, again, I think they can all be useful, depending on circumstance and a person's situation. But to make them the be-all and end-all is one of the great tragedies of our time.
Yeah, and I've already I already said this once, but I think for anybody listening, that the value of these ideas, this kind of therapy, again, I would say is being able to put words to these concepts. And by doing that, they become less daunting. So some of these things can seem so daunting, you know, the fear of death and how that can manifest, or the fear of isolation, which, you know, for me, I think the isolation part was my main thing that I struggled with when I was young. And, you know, so being able to put words to view these things more conceptually is in itself healing and allows you to delve into them more than otherwise. You know, when you're young, these things can seem so daunting and so powerful. And I think it's, there's something about being able to tame the ideas that helps face them. Yeah.
That's a great point, Zach. Just having somebody who can relate to you and who can have a conversation with you about these things, and who's not, you know, scared out of their mind to talk about them. Just that can help. Gives you some understanding, some sense that others have been down through this road before.
Exactly. Yeah. And that actually, I just thought of it, but one of the benefits of therapy, that when I talk to people about therapy, you know, sometimes there's that sense that people have of, what does this person really know about me, or how much do they really know? And I think, you know, even if the person you're going to see is in theory not even that good, I think there's value just to getting different points of view. And that's what I tell people about a therapy when I'm trying to describe the benefits. It's like just getting a different point of view alone and seeing your problem from a different point of view. And, you know, you're always the one who can pick and choose from those ideas at the end of the day and see what appeals to you. But just that value of getting new ideas and new perspectives alone is sometimes just so valuable in itself.
Totally agree.
It's one interesting thing that I've read in Yalom's book, which I have seen in my life, is that he talks about, and I'm talking about his book, Existential Psychotherapy.
Right.
He talks about how many therapists who are more traditional psychotherapy and other therapies, more traditional therapists, they seem to want to avoid these more existential topics for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And I've had that experience talking to therapists. It's almost as if they don't want to open up such existential kinds of questions due to those questions being so unanswerable and deep and, you know, theoretically troublesome to resolve. And I even had a therapist basically tell me that directly once when I was seeing him for anxiety, and I had asked him about existential psychology because I was reading about it at the time. And he basically said in so many words, yeah, we don't really like to get into those deep questions. And didn't give me much detail about, you know, why that was, but I'm curious if Yalom's observation rings true for you, and do you think that these kinds of topics are avoided by many therapists? And if so, do you think that should change?
Yes, and yes. I think it's a major problem, but I don't think it's just therapists. I think it's our culture, our whole culture, maybe Western culture, industrialized culture, is oriented around efficiency, again, speed, instant results, appearance and packaging of things. That's our socioeconomic system. It drives so many, many levels of our functioning in society. So it's not surprising that it's impacted psychology and psychiatry as well. That said, I don't want to say that the only reasons that therapists, be they behavioral, cognitive, what have you, stay away from some of those questions is because they're not able to go there themselves very well, or they're scared of going there. I think they may have some good clinical reasons for doing it too. I do think that for certain people and under certain circumstances, delving into, you know, very ungrounded inquiries could be destabilizing, could be too much if somebody is particularly fragile or at an early stage of therapy, let's say. You know, there could be other reasons for not delving into that. I think it's this is where being in good communication with your client and really trying to sense what is the client's desire and capacity for deeper change in their lives is so important. That's why I call myself an existential integrative therapist, because I do believe that there are many tools in the toolbox of healing, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that there are times where, you know, more programmatic approaches or medical approaches, somatic, you know, meditative approaches can be helpful, like simple breathing exercises, mm-hmm. Relaxation, et cetera, supportive work. And deeper exploration is not for everyone, again. Mm-hmm. But I believe strongly that our profession should make much more available the chance for clients to go more deeply into these questions, and that therapists as a whole should be more prepared, both within themselves personally and professionally, to deal with the wider and deeper ranges of human experience. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise it shortchanges what could happen there. And it also could be mystifying to the client in the sense of how seductive more structured, simplistic formulations can be. They can be very seductive. They give people answers in a sense. And I think we all, especially when we're in pain, we want something quick and simple that we can work on. And it could cut that person off from even knowing what it might be like to stay more present to that particular quandary that they have, let's say, about feeling like there's a bottomless pit under them, or they're in a black hole, or they're in a free fall. I mean, we hear these kinds mm-hmm. of themes. These are existential themes that are behind so much anxiety, but they're so often not really explored.
Yeah, that's an interesting angle of inquiry is talking about the words and phrases that people use to describe, you know, how they feel and how those phrases yeah. tie to, you know, these core existential fears. That's interesting. I don't know if you've written about that or other people have.
Well, I have some, and what I find is that the deeper people go into their anxieties, often the more these metaphors come up around, you know, free fall or fearing that they're drowning or disappearing. And I believe that that's because we have a harder and harder time wrapping our words around the experience. Experience is much more powerful than any word can contain. So that's where I think it's, if you're just coming at that person from a standpoint of, you know, talking about it or trying to give an explanation, you're not really reaching mm-hmm. that person where they need to be reached, which is, again, in terms of their whole body experience of the problem and giving space to that, which is sometimes wordless. It's more attending to what they're feeling, sensing, imaging. Mm-hmm.
Being willing to really feel that feeling in the moment as opposed to pushing it away. Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
So yeah, to your points, it's, you know, talking about some therapists not wanting to deal with these kinds of topics. It has surprised me since I've learned more about these ideas and how powerful I consider them. It's really surprising to me how rarely people seem to talk about these issues. And I think it gets to that, you know, like you said, the cultural thing of like, we don't like to talk about, you know, death. We put that aside and nobody talks about it, even though it's such a fundamental existential part of our, you know, of our existence. And I think it's the same thing for the other, you know, these core stressors. It's, we'd rather just set them aside and, you know, only deal with them in these moments at 3 a.m. when we wake up and, you know, for a few moments, you know,
when
we're forced to, or when they culminate in something, you know, quite bad or whatever. But yeah, it's mm-hmm. these ideas just seem so powerful to me. And I agree with you. It's like the more we can get these ideas out there, I think the better it is for humanity. And maybe this is a good segue actually too, because I see this related to political polarization. And so maybe this is a good segue to talk about, you know, you've worked on polarization, political polarization topics. You wrote a book on polarization. And I'm curious if you could give a your view on how you see existential humanistic therapy and psychology relating to the polarization topics.
Yes, well, in The Polarized Mind, I go into detail about an area that drives polarization that I don't think is nearly addressed enough in our mainstream way of thinking about how people become extremist or polarized. And that is the existential humanistic fear of insignificance, of not mattering, which again, I believe goes back to this primal fear that we all experience in some way at birth, you know, that sense of overwhelming helplessness, the sense of not having any direction or identity structure to hold the floundering, you know, the confusion of that abrupt shift from relative non-existence to existence. So I think what happens in trauma, both personal and collective, is that that primal terror begins to break through, because what happens in trauma, again, personal and collective, it's like a rip in the fabric of the routine and familiar. And if you think about that on a collective scale, let's say, just looking at the 20th century, I point to, I think, some glaring examples of, you know, Maoist China, Stalinist Russia, Hitler's Germany. Each of those countries went through some horrifying experiences of insignificance and a feeling like they didn't count. Whether you take the treaty at Versailles with the Germans after World War II and how screwed over they felt as a people, as a culture, by the rest of the world, the depression that they went into, and already having insecurities about their nationality, if you will, because they were very late in becoming a nation relative to other European nations. So deep, what we would call ontological insecurities about one's identity, and also falling from such a great height, that crash, because in Germany there was such a marvelous tradition of art and literature and science, philosophy, so many areas. And to come crashing down after the war profoundly brings these existential themes. Then you have Russia, you know, coming from the Tsarist rule and the experience of many of the people, the proletariat, if you will, of being so put down, and such distinctions between classes, the royalty versus the regular folks. And of course, you had this in the French Revolution as well. And you have this in China, too, as far as I understand. You know, the extreme oppression the Chinese people felt, especially from nations like England and the United States, the colonial powers, colonial West, exploiting them and making them feel basically like serfs and slaves, and in some cases being treated that way. It was ripe for a strong arm to arise, and for a people to arise with the feeling that I will do everything I can, including becoming a tyrannical myself, to avoid any hint of that former feeling of insignificance and smallness and helplessness. So I believe that this is what drives a lot of our tendencies toward authoritarianism, toward tyranny, fascism. But not just in the political realm. You know, we see it within family systems.
Narcissistic behavior.
Narcissistic, patriarchal, abusive, domestic abuse can certainly be driven by that. We see it in, you know, business, monopolistic, hegemonic, you know, businesses, corporations, professions, we've seen it as well. I think of the Nazi doctors, but that's an extreme example. I mean, God knows my own profession has had its arrogance and its ideological rigidity and so many areas of life.
It really seems like when it comes to, you know, arrogance and narcissistic traits, I mean, that there's something, you know, as humans, we do crave certainty and we do crave, we crave a feeling of groundedness. And, you know, one way to achieve that is with narcissistic behavior, to not let in any, you know, other philosophies or thoughts, and to say, this is the way it is. And that can be a solution of some sort to feelings of existential terror, even if that terror has like been pushed aside long ago and buried deep beneath. I think that accounts for a lot of narcissistic behavior. I'm not sure if you would agree with that, Ben.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a craving for certainty, especially when one feels so terribly uncertain and ungrounded. And that often happens again because one has experienced some kind of break, some kind of trauma, some kind of devaluation in their lives. Humiliation is often related that they can't deal with. And so that's the other side of the polarized mind, is how to depolarize, you know, how do we address this problem? And that's the lead to my follow-up book, which is The Depolarizing of America, as I call it, a guidebook for social healing. So I think we got to get to those deeper fears, to those more primal fears, if we're going to substantively address polarization politically, culturally, racially, personally. Otherwise, you're rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
I totally agree. And that's, will. I mean, that for me, that is what connects these two things too, or how I see the existential psychology ideas and polarization. And for me, it's recognizing that we're all human and we're all just a bunch of individuals. And that's why I kind of aim for avoiding these. I think one of the fundamental mechanisms behind political polarization, you know, in the U.S., but any place this has happened, and it's happened obviously many places, the fundamental mechanism is in thinking in these group terms, where like this group is all this way and this other group is, you know, they're all as bad as the worst person in that group. And when you start to think that way, and when you start to act that way, when you start to see this group as a monolith and not as a bunch of just individuals who may change, or some of them come over to your side if you speak persuasively or whatever, if you start viewing them as this monolithic group that can't change, that changes how you behave, that changes how you speak to them. And the insults that people make about that group then in turn amplify the other group who's doing this similar things. And I see this as connected too, because to me, it's about seeing people as people, as humans. Absolutely. Like ourselves. They have understandable reasons for what they do. And, you know, it may be that we find it hard to find common ground or build bridges with them, but I feel like the first step in the solution is seeing other people as people like yourselves. Yes. and seeing their humanity.
Well, that, yes. I mean, we scapegoat others because they remind us of the primal terror. Somehow those others trigger the feelings of helplessness and groundlessness that we can't handle because of whatever context, whatever particular context we went through. I also just want to emphasize that I don't intend to pick out just certain groups or parties as the perpetrators of the polarized mind. I think we're all susceptible to it, and we all need to be vigilant. And I believe, and I point out in my book, that America has committed some horrible crimes in the context of these fears of insecurity, insignificance, and not having really dealt with profound insecurities. I mean, some of those may have to do with, you know, being immigrants for a number of us, escaping profound oppression in other countries. Even though we found, quote, freedom in some ways, we also carried with us these insecurity mentalities that led to horrible scapegoating of others, you know, be they Africans or Indian, Native Americans, etc. So anyway, we're all susceptible. I think the larger point here is finding ways of addressing these fears so that we're not coming so much from a place of such deficits toward each other, but coming more from a place, like you say, of being able to see the humanity, the wholeness of the person, rather than just a part. And that's what a lot of the depolarizing of America is about. And my recent work with Braver Angels and these dialogue groups, the Experiential Democracy Dialogue, I see that in particular as a notable way to change the atmosphere of our relating to others. They're really about helping people to humanize the encounter with the other, rather than coming from a place of knee-jerk stereotyping and labeling. But it presents a series of ways to help people be more centered and more okay with the other within themselves, which is really fundamental, so that they can be more okay with the otherness in the other, if you will, mm-hmm. and have a dialogue.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the sad thing about these polarization dynamics is that how you view other people is how you view yourself, and vice versa. Like these are all just views about humanity, and you know, as polarization dynamics progress, it leads to this really, you know, people start having a really negative view of humanity, of the other, you know, and including including themselves, you know, in that way. In the same way you're saying, it's like these are two sides of the same coin. We are a form of humanity in the same way others are a form of humanity. So having, you know, the more pessimistic things get, it leads to worse and worse situations, unfortunately, in a lot of cases where people just start having a really negative view of humanity in general, which, you know, leads to the worst things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a road toward becoming more whole human beings.
mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing I think about sometimes with the polarization dynamics is that there can be something about the modern age that's a bit destabilizing, about in the sense that we're more easily able to learn about other philosophies and other points of view than ever before, you know, and I include like the last, you know, couple hundred years or so, when people can more easily learn about what's going on in other places. And mm-hmm. related to what we've been talking about, there can be something kind of destabilizing in the sense that we crave certainty. We crave these, we crave these philosophies of this is the way life should be, or the way the world is. And the more we learn that, hey, there's all these other philosophies out there, and all these other perspectives of seeing the world, that alone, even apart from like directly impacting one's life, but just at a philosophical or intellectual level, I feel like that alone can be a bit destabilizing, because we do, you know, like we've been saying, we do crave certainty. And I'm wondering if that's something you've seen talked about, or you yourself have talked about.
Well, very much so. But I guess I see it as double-edged, because on the one hand, I strongly agree that the ready access to various cultures and ways of thinking can be overwhelming and destabilizing.
Vertigo-inducing.
It, you know, it puts us into our silos, our dogmas, our ideological orthodoxies, because we don't, you know, it's too much. And I think the 60s also in America had something to do with that. It pushed a lot of people to become more narrow and more linear in their behaving and thinking, simply because it felt safer, and it's too scary to entertain all these different ideas and lifestyles, etc. But on the other hand, I also think an interesting phenomenon of, let's say, the Zoom calls that we have now and reliance on our devices, is it opens us up to many more cultures, ways of thinking that we never had access to before. And that's potentially a silver lining, depending on how we handle that. I certainly have felt very enriched by a number of the Zoom conferences and presentations I've been a part of from people all over the world. You just never have that, or very rarely, in a more live, person-to-person kind of settings. So if you can use those opportunities to, again, be more present, to stay with each other and explore each other's ideas and work with your own reactivity around that, it could really enrich and advance, I think, our capacity to innovate, our capacities to discover more about ourselves and each other, and could lead to more vital ways of living.
It reminds me of, I was saying something about social media recently, where in a similar way, there's all these stresses that are come with social media in the internet age, where you're more on display, you're having to say things publicly and have to interact with people in different frames of reference, which leads to all sorts of stresses and distortions and misunderstandings. But within that, even with those stresses, related to existential psychology, I would say, is by confronting those stresses, all the stresses that we experience in life have the capacity to lead us to a greater wisdom about what life is. So in the case of social media, with all those stresses, there's also the path to recognizing, for example, that we are not defined by the presentation we make to other people, even though it can seem that way at times, right? That we feel judged or we feel, angry. It's like reaching this realization that we are more than the perceptions that other people have of us, as one step to one sort of wisdom in that area. Just reminded me of all of these stresses that we experience are potential paths to greater wisdom. And I think that's what, getting back to the existential psychology is being willing to examine those stresses and what they tell you
exactly
about life and making peace with them and saying, well, this is just how the world is. Like, yeah, people are going to think things of me, but that is not who I am. It's not the full definition of me, things like that.
That's why we talk about the paradoxical self, being able to live with and even be enriched by the various contrasts and contradictions that we experience in life, within ourselves and with others. That can, yes, be a wonderful ground for discovery, for growth, or it could be overwhelming. But again, the key is presence, or at least a key is cultivating presence. And I think that really is our biggest challenge today, because there are so many forces that go against being able to cultivate presence. Our attention spans are being, I think, severely compromised.
Destroyed.
Because it'd be wonderful to do what you were saying, to be able to explore and play within the sea of social media. The problem is that's not how a lot of people experience. I think they experience it more as flitting back and forth and getting excited and getting mad and then getting stuck and getting depressed because this image or that image.
A lot of anger going on, yeah.
A lot of anger, reactivity. So I believe we need more people to help us slow down, to process a lot of this. This is where I believe psychology can play a great role. It is challenged itself in doing that. But there are certainly many areas where people can step up in these ways, and the ways of mentoring and just reminding us, certainly our artists often, and some of the great literary works, and remind us of our fuller humanity and of the value of being in great conversations with people and with ourselves. The value of pausing, of taking time to find one's way through all this.
That was an interview with Kirk Schneider. You can learn more about him at his site, kirkjschneider.com. He's on Twitter at kschneider56. You can find his books on Amazon or wherever you buy your books at. Just to remind you of a few titles of his book to pique your interest: Awakening to All, The Spirituality of All, The Polarized Mind, Horror and the Holy, and The Paradoxical Self. So those are just a few of his books there. If you enjoy learning about psychology and therapy-related topics, I have some earlier episodes on the subject of anxiety and on schizophrenia and psychosis. In a couple of those, I talk about my own mental struggles as a young man, which led to me having to drop out of college suddenly mid-year. You might also enjoy checking out the piece I wrote about existential psychology and the strangeness of life, which you can find by searching for Zach Elwood Medium. If the subject of the psychology behind people's political polarization interests you, there are quite a few books I'd recommend on that topic. I'll put that on the page for this episode at my site, behavior-podcast.com, if you want to check those out. This is the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. If you've enjoyed this podcast, would you be willing to do me a huge favor and leave me a review on iTunes or another podcast platform? Might you be willing to share this podcast with your acquaintances? It would mean a lot to me and would make it more likely that I continue to do this podcast in the future. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.